You're listening to Symposium, a year-round conference in the arts, brought to you by Pipeline Artists.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to What to Expect When You're Expecting to Work in a TV Room. No one is pregnant here, I don't think, so we're not having babies. So tonight, we're going to have a whole lively conversation with TV writers who are working in rooms or have worked in rooms to give you some sort of idea of what it's really like. Like, a lot of people out there are like, oh, I want to be a TV writer. Well, hopefully you still will want to be one at the end of this. I'm Jeannie, everyone knows me, Pipeline Artist, Matt Misetich. And Allie, would you like to introduce yourself and let everybody know your background in TV? And
hello. Yes, I'm Allie Floral, a comedy writer. My background, I've worked in a lot of different stuff. Half-hour TV, I worked at Conan for a couple of years. I wrote some episodes of BoJack Horseman. I wrote on School of Rock. I also produced an indie comedy feature and also worked in like the web world. Did a web series called TV Guide Letter Theater that was on Funny or Die, and a series called Internet Common Theater on Mashable. So that's me.
And Sean.
Hey, so my name is Sean. I'm originally from the East Coast. I was a journalist for 10 years, and I moved to LA in 2018. And my first room was Michael Shore's reboot of Field of Dreams, which can be seen on Peacock starting next spring, I think is the target air date. And I just got into the Chicago PD room about 2 weeks ago. So that'll be season 10, which starts in September, I believe. So, yeah.
And Ronnie. So I recognize her from past symposiums.
Yes. Hi, everybody. I'm Ronnie Brown. I got my start in my first room after being on the production side of things on Black Dynamite on Adult Swim. Since then, I've been working freelance or in various rooms. Most recently, I was in a room for Nickelodeon, and right now I'm in a room for Disney Junior. So I'm navigating the preschool television writing world right now.
Yikes. Yeah. Yikes. As someone who's had preschoolers, and Allie has one right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a lot.
That's a repetition. Yeah.
Yep. You can run some of your stuff by Allie's daughter and see what kind of reaction you get.
I actually should. Thank you.
I'm curious how you guys each like broke in. Like, did you start off wanting to be TV writers, or did you start off wanting to be feature writers? And like, what was your transition from aspiring to that offer in the room? Ronnie, you want to go first?
Well, I always knew that I wanted to write, but I had no idea how you actually get into these spaces, because you know, I can go online and look up a production coordinator job, or look up, you know, an executive assistant job and all these different other types of jobs, but you don't necessarily, at least to my knowledge, I've never seen a job posting for a screenwriter or, you know, a staff writer or anything like that. So the question is, well, how do I break in? And I actually got a little bit lost. I started off doing casting for reality TV and just basically getting in where I fit in production wise. Until I got, it was actually kind of lucky, because I was doing some transcription at the time. I answered a Craigslist ad for a typist, and it ended up being Black Dynamite on Adult Swim. It was just luck meets preparation in that moment. And that's where, for me, it was just literally synergy and life kind of guiding me. Even when I got lost, it was like, okay, here is the actual path. And so from there, I basically used my production experience and let them know, hey, I'm writing. Is anybody going to foster me? Is anybody willing to help me get into the position? And the showrunner was, you know, thankfully gracious enough to help me. Since then, it's been trying to keep up that luck meets preparation momentum.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, that is a kind of roundabout way to get in. And if you had not presented yourself in the production side of it as competent, reliable, all of those things, you know, that that also helps them recognize you as, hey, maybe this is somebody we want to keep working with. And
exactly. Yeah.
That's great. What about you, Allie?
Well, in terms of comedy, I feel like it started at, I always wanted to write and I always told stories and I drew out stories when I was little. And I also had to wear a chin gear for 5 years, which was really socially awkward. And so I think that's probably what brought me into comedy. And then also my parents getting a video camera they couldn't use. That was the start of it. But I went to film school at Ithaca College. So I knew I was, and I got to intern and live out here for a summer through school and kind of had an idea of like, okay, that's where I'm going to go. It seemed easier to start in LA than in New York. So I moved out here with $1,200 and a really shitty car. And I was lucky where a friend from college got me my first job working for a talent manager. So I was able to kind of get some insight into how the business worked and also the pressure of it and being on a busy desk and that kind of stuff. So I went up kind of that route where I worked for a talent manager. Then I got a job as a showrunner's assistant on a show and then writer's assistant, script coordinator. And then I started working at Conan and started writing with a partner there who was working at Conan Scott. And and he and I started, so I was on the Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien, which people may or may not remember that was on for, and that show got canceled. And so we had some downtime. And so Scott and I shot a web series for $100 called TV Guide Letter Theater. And that was something where we actually ended up getting national press and like, it helped us like with talking to reps and we started writing pilots and, started kind of making the rounds of meetings. So you can make something for $100 that actually can do something. It's easier now than it when I did it. Cause now they have like the iPhone 13. But yeah, so those samples eventually got read by the right people. And also just like relationships, with like BoJack, I had known the producers before. That's how we got the opportunity to write for them. School of Rock, it was like an exec at Nickelodeon had read one of our samples, brought us in. We met with the showrunners for the first season. We didn't actually get hired that season, but they brought us back for the second season. Then we were hired for 2 seasons. So it's kind of be nice to everyone is the thing I always say. Cause like, you don't know like what, which opportunity will lead to which. Mm-hmm. And like my first assistant job, like I got a bunch of different random production jobs because people liked me there. And cause I did things with a smile and, people helped me in the way. I found and met my writing mentor there too. So, that's sort of my roundabout way.
Yeah. I love that. And Sean, share with us how you broke in and went from journalism to this type of writing.
Yeah. And I mean, this has been great listening to Allison and Ronnie because like the two ways that they broke in are so different and the way that I broke in is different from those two as well. So it's kind of awesome listening to their experiences. But I lived in Virginia my entire life until I was 31. I never left the state. I thought I was going to die there. And I wrote a pilot in 2017. And I kind of had, I've told Matt about this, I've kind of had this weird existential moment of dread where I was like, I don't know what to do with this pilot because I have no connections to Los Angeles. I'm a journalism professor. That's what I do. And so I Googled, you know, screenplay competitions and Script Pipeline came up and Austin Film Festival came up and several other prominent ones. And so I figured, you know, the only link that I could possibly have to get to LA was maybe making a name for myself in one of these, you know, competitions or fellowships. So I just started doing that. I started researching the big ones and tried to save money by only entering the ones that I thought were reputable. And over the course of 18 months, I won several. I placed runner-up in several, including a couple of Script Pipeline ones. And I came out to LA for, you know, the awards thing here, which was great. And but long story short, I was able to use those placements to get a manager. And then I flew out and moved. I flew out, scouted out some apartments, moved out to LA. And when I moved out here, I won't say who the manager was because I don't want to besmirch anyone's name, but I was with him for 20 months and it kind of felt like momentum was wearing off. He didn't like some of the stuff I was writing. And so we had an amicable split and I signed with another manager at 3 Arts named Luke Maxwell. And I you know, kept writing. And this was right around the beginning of the pandemic. And he straight up told me, look, it might take a year or a year and a half to start getting you some serious staffing meetings, because we have no idea what the pandemic's going to do. This was March 2020 when I signed with him. So literally like a week before everything changed forever. But sure enough, about 18 months later, he submitted me for a staffing meeting for Field of Dreams, Michael Shore's reboot, which I mentioned before. And when this stuff happens, it happens quick. I got a text message in August of 2021 saying, hey, Sean, do you like baseball? Which is like a very strange, lacking context message to get from your manager. Not knowing where it's going, I basically said, yes, I like baseball, but I don't, you know, I'm not obsessed with it. He said, great, I can work with that. And that was it. 6 weeks later, I get another text that says, you have a meeting with Michael Shore tomorrow. So get ready. It's happening tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And so it's like less than 24 hours notice. I'm meeting with one of the top showrunners of the last 20 years. Meeting went great. And I got the call about 3 weeks after that, that I got into the room. My journey was very different than Allison and Ronnie's, in that I spent my entire life on the East Coast. Then I moved here, and then 3 years to the day that I arrived in Los Angeles was when I started in the writer's room of Field of Dreams. So it was a combination of getting scripts into the right hands, letting your reps do the work. And I have very, very good reps. I've heard horror stories about reps. You know, my first rep, like I said, I left him, but I didn't feel like he was sabotaging my career. We just had different visions. I've heard of reps who were absolutely atrocious. But my current reps are great, and they're getting me meetings, and they've gotten me my first two gigs. And now I'm a story editor on Chicago PD because they got me that one too. So, yeah.
Sweet. And it's feel like 3 years.
Three arcs that Sean is repped by, I don't know if you mentioned.
Yeah.
Sorry. Say that again. I didn't hear you.
Three arts you're repped by. I don't know if you mentioned.
Yes. Yes. I'm repped by three arts, and my agents are at A3, and then they've both been getting me great meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like 3 years isn't very long.
No, I will keep this very short because I don't want to like take all the time, but
we got lots of time.
I met a great EP in the room for Field of Dreams, which, by the way, like Michael Shore, everything you've heard about him, he's brilliant, he's kind, he's funny, he's just great at story. And one of the co-EPs was this wonderful woman named Lisa Muse Bryant. And she told me it took her 5 years to get her first staff job. And once that was done, it took her 5 years to get her second staff job. Mm-hmm. And so that's a decade of only two jobs that she had. By the way, she had three kids in between those 10 years. And so it's like, you know, listening to her, by the way, I consider her to be a much better writer than me, more talented writer. She's a co-EP level now. So she obviously has the chops because she's been, I think most recently she was the showrunner of Kenan on NBC. And so this is a very hardworking, talented individual. And it took her a decade to get two jobs. Mm-hmm. And so like what you said, you know, is a perfect, you know, comment that 3 years seems quick. It is. I feel extremely fortunate to go from moving here to staff writer to story editor in essentially 3.5 years feels like a great trajectory and a very fortunate trajectory. So.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question, actually. Just a reminder to everybody who's in the, you can use the Q&A box if you want to throw in a question, and we'll kind of filter them in as we go. I have a question, I guess, for all of you, though. Sean said it took 18 months to get, you know, from point A to point B, essentially. In between that time, you had another job. You weren't just sitting around writing specs, right? I mean, you have to make a living somehow. Did all of you early on have a side job while you were writing as well, or did it just kind of, you jumped into it and it just sort of worked out?
Yeah, I was going to say, I always have side jobs, as you know, Matt.
Yeah, I know. Why aren't you reading scripts right now?
I actually just finished some, but I feel like having the side jobs not only help, you know, with paying bills and stuff like that, but it helps you in those in between times because you actually never know, you know, if your next gig is going to come quickly or if it's going to be 5 years. So it does help to be multifaceted and, you know, have a side hustle or have something else that you do that brings in some money, especially, you know, I feel like if you're fortunate enough to get on a television show that has multiple seasons, you know, you come in kind of being employed for a while. Like for me, for animation, our jobs do tend to last a little bit longer, like, you know, a year, 2 years, a couple years per season. So, you know, you can have some type of stability, but in general, it's not really stable. So having something else really helps.
It's a lot easier to be a dentist. Right. When people are like, I remember when I joined the guild, they said, like, it's a feast or famine business. Like, you could be on, you know, a show like Desperate Housewives for 10 years and then suddenly everything dries up. So I think it's besides learning to have some discipline with writing, it's really good to learn to have some discipline with money. And I definitely always I moved out to LA with nothing. I didn't have I didn't know people in the business. I didn't have a lot of money. But so I always was working. But I was lucky that I got to at least start doing assistant jobs in entertainment. So I was meeting the people I wanted to meet.
Is one of the realities, though, that, you know, you get your first staff job, that doesn't necessarily mean like, well, I'm set, I'll never have to like work some other job in the industry or some other job period again. And I feel like writers think that that's the case, and that's oftentimes not the case. Not only is it not the case, but you're not like a failure if that's what the course of action is, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could have a pandemic happen. You could have a show get canceled. I mean, you could also, I've spun my wheels in development where it didn't go anywhere. Right. I had a pilot option like a couple of years ago where we were pitching it forever and unfortunately it didn't go anywhere. But I mean, I'm grateful we got to do that. But you just don't know. So I think it's really smart to also light as many fires as possible. Not actual fires, just so you guys know, because it's California and that's bad. Please don't have a gender reveal party with flames.
I was going to say, there's nothing wrong with being on the production side of things, because from my experience, that's how I've been able to get next to showrunners and producers and other decision makers, that when I tell them, hey, I also write, it's like, oh, crap. Like, let me see your stuff. Like, because they already know me and I have a rapport. So, you know, if you're interested in production, then definitely go for it.
And what about you, Sean, in terms of, you know, bringing home the bacon? You're muted. I know.
My bad.
And you want to be a staff writer.
Yeah, I know, right? Drinking too much of this. So I love telling this part, because a lot of people really, like, they're one of the biggest questions is, should I move to Los Angeles, right? And so I was extremely lucky to have a wife who wanted to move with me to L.A. She had experience moving everywhere. I had never moved ever. And so she said, look, you know, people do this. And so if you want to move, let's move. And so we did. We came out here. We had about 15K saved up, which I recommend having at least that much saved up if you come out here, especially if you're by yourself. If you have a partner, then you can usually make it work a little easier. But when we came out here for that first, so for a couple of months, neither one of us had a job. She got a job as an assistant on Judge Judy, believe it or not. Then a few months after that, I got a job teaching at a community college called Pierce College in Woodland Hills. And I had, like I said, I was teaching in Virginia. So I had a master's degree. I had university experience. And so I was able to leverage that for a pretty good paying job as a journalism professor at Pierce. And so I did that for a good 2 years, actually probably about 2.5 years by the time I left. But, you know, working in education, you like at least for community colleges, if you're teaching, you do have downtime that you can use to write, that you can use to network, that you can use to take general meetings, which I was doing all that stuff. And then the pandemic hit and we started working from home, and I was still doing that. And I wrote Wonder Drug from home. And yeah, I mean, a really brilliant and accessible manager who's on Twitter, his name's John Zerzerny. You know, we've had multiple conversations where he's told me, look, you know, I tell my clients, do not quit your day job. Like, that one of the worst things you could be as a writer is almost broke and desperate and writing from that place of desperation. Because, like, I'm not saying no good art has ever come from desperation, because I'm sure there have been stories about that, very well publicized stories. But the reason they're stories is because they're rare. They are not the majority. Like, writers need to have some sort of income if they can manage it any way possible. If you can get full-time employment while you're writing, even better. If it's less stressful, even better. And my teaching job at Pierce was like very non-stressful. The students were amazing and my bosses knew what I wanted to do. So there was no weird, like, you know, walking around keeping a secret that I might leave. They knew at some point I was going to leave and they were fine with that. They just said, you know, while you're here, do your work. And so, yeah, that's, I was employed the entire time until my manager texted me and said, Michael Shore just submitted your name to the studio for approval. I was like, literally, I got that text while I was at work because I was working. And so that's my recommendation is definitely have a day job if you can manage it.
Well, and if something goes wrong, you can always lead sessions for us at Symposium now that I know you're a teacher.
Yes, my rate is a lot of beer and $10 an hour. Okay, I will not do anything less than that.
I think Matt can handle that.
I'll think about it.
It is, writing is a little bit like acting in that you just don't know what's going to lead to what. And meeting as many people as possible, just showing them what you can do. I'm going to probably misquote a little bit, but Bryan Cranston talked about auditions that, like, you go in, you show them what you can do and you leave and you don't think about it. And it's the same thing with writing. It's like you have someone read your script, hope maybe you get a meeting where you get to show them what your voice is and who you are as a person, but you can't take all the rejection personally, which is easier said than done. Therapy is really important as a writer too, along with figuring out financial stuff. But it is just like, you got to keep your nose at the grindstone and just keep writing.
Yeah. I want to pop over to the Q&A box for a second and pull in some questions from our audience. Somebody asked if this was live or pre-recorded. It is live. Ronnie and Allie, what is it like working on animated shows? And BoJack is my favorite show.
Jack is
not my favorite show, but it's there. I'm sure it could be my favorite show. So talk a little bit about animation and how that's different than maybe working in another room or, you know, and the differences of a career trajectory and all that. I know Ronnie already mentioned the seasons are like 2 years.
It's delayed gratification because, I mean, I was working at Conan and then left to go work at BoJack. And Conan was like, you could pitch something and it was like on the air that day. Like, oh, let's put an ostrich in it, you know, I don't know, whatever they were doing. And animation, it's like, you have to wait months to see the final picture. So it's definitely more delayed gratification than like live action. But I mean, I really enjoyed animation. It's cool to get to see the steps. For the first season of BoJack, normally they would take 12 months and 6 months. So it was kind of a jam-packed schedule. They suddenly got picked up and it was like crazy.
Yeah, it's for me, like I've been on both sides. I've been in animation production. I actually have a degree in animation, which is like, who does that? But yeah, like animation is my jam, and it's something that I've always wanted to work in since I was a child. And so, being able to do this as for a living is just like I'm living my dream. And sometimes it's a nightmare, but it's still my dream. So it's really cool. I love the process. I love the pipeline of animation from beginning to end. I love, you know, seeing going from the script and then doing a table read and then doing the record session and seeing the storyboards and the animatics and final picture and all that type of stuff. And like Ali said, it is delayed gratification. The show that I'm on right now is a 3D animated series. And so I think from script to post, each episode is about 6 to 8 months to produce. Wow. So it takes some time. And even though they started writing the first season last summer, it's not premiering until next fall. Wow. So the production process is long. But being in that room versus live action stuff, I feel they're pretty much the same. I would just say the big difference for me that I've noticed when it comes to the writing is for animation, we give more direction. So, cause we have to direct the board artists and be very specific with certain things that's going to be called out during production. So we're putting more information into the scripts.
Is it sort of like, you know, when they say to people who are writing for live action, like, don't tell the actor what to do, blah, 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 but you kind of are telling them what to do, like the artist what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, I will say with BoJack also, the animators did, I mean, yes, of course they were directed by like the creator and the writers, but like also there's a lot of like background jokes in BoJack, and like some of that was writers, but some of that was like the animators would just like think of something, and it's right. really fun. Like there's a lot of fun stuff to find. And then also that show, we always did a table read with the full cast depending on availability, and getting to, I mean, if you are making people laugh without seeing the world, like that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. And we had amazing, the cast there was just awesome.
Cool. Okay, Sean, what's it like navigating the move from the East to the West? And they said they love New York City, but they're iffy towards LA. Like, was that a big transition for you from Virginia to Los Angeles?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, especially like I've already said a couple of times, you know, having always lived in Virginia, that was kind of, that was my true north in a way. Like, that's all I knew. That's the direction I was always in. And so going out West was, it wasn't difficult. In Los Angeles, if you're going to move anywhere, moving to a place where it's like perpetually 75 degrees and sunny is like, you know, probably the best option. And so what's going to sound extremely weird is that other than like my family, who I miss a lot because they all live in Richmond, the biggest difference has been literally the weather, because in Virginia, it'll be 25 degrees one day and like in the morning, and then you know, 5 hours later, it's 72 and you're like, what is going on here? This is like the world's worst thing. And so in LA, it's like, you know, you wake up and it's 60 and then it's 75 and that's about it. And so, yeah, as someone just said, Virginia's weather is bipolar. It is. It's insane. And as someone who has a lot of allergies, it was also ridiculous to live in that situation for 30 years and not realize how bad it was.
Does weather affect your creative abilities?
It does, because if I'm cold, you know, I don't want to write, Matt. Okay. You know, I know you're trying to get me back. No, but it's a fair question. The answer is I'm skipping that. I would say that moving to LA, I mean, I kind of covered it a little bit before, but as long as you have a little bit of savings and if you can get a job, the transition really is not that hard. Now, obviously, if you come out here without savings, which I do not recommend, I would always have some money saved up. Every time someone talks to me, I'm like, that's the number one. I mean, some people will say that the calculation is six months rent. Have 6 months rent saved up and enough for like an extra $250 to $300 a month in addition to that. So, you know, if you calculate that in LA, $2,000 is usually minimum for rent times 6 months. That's 12 grand plus another $350 for six more months. That's around $2,200, $2,300. So, you know, having about 15, 16K is, unless you want to have severe like a psychological pressure of like a mental health and like, am I going to be homeless next month? I would have something like that ready when you move to LA.
I came out with 1200, but that was also like a decade plus ago. So
right now is less, but I had a job when I came out.
I did not have a job. So I knew that it was going to be probably about 6 months, and it was. I mean, I got out here at the end of November. And then I think around the beginning of June is when I got the teaching job. So it was just about 6.5 months. I feel like I'm rambling at this point, but that's kind of my biggest answer is my transition was very smooth, but it's because I think that I prepared fairly well for the journey and for the duration.
But what I love about everything, the three of you were just saying, is that everything was different. You know, someone with not a lot of money and no job, somebody with a lot of money saved and no job, somebody with even less money saved, but a job. Like I feel like it's a personal thing of what your risk level, like what your comfort level is at risk and starvation.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have kids. I was like 22 when I moved. So like, I didn't have pets, I didn't have kids, I wasn't married, I am now, like, so it was a bit easier to take that risk. If like I was moving out here with four kids, that would be different, but also I'm not going to have four kids, so that's cool, but one's good.
But yeah, totally. And also it's interesting too, like all three of you, I know you all have partners and, you know, there is a different dynamic as, you know, with them being 22 years old and, you know, free as a bird. And, you know, sometimes I feel like to make a big leap like that, sometimes ignorance is bliss. Like you have no idea what you're getting into and just jump and leap, you know?
Yeah. Someone had a question. Someone had a question on agents, and that we get asked this on almost every town hall. And I'm curious what they have to say. Because Sean, for example, and I'm curious what Allie and Ronnie, how that sort of progressed. But Sean, you had a manager first rather than an agent. That's usually the progression of things, right? For writers. I think sometimes newer writers tend to get it backwards. I mean, sometimes you get an agent first, then the manager, or just the agent or whatever. But your manager was the one that helps you connect with the with agents at some point, right?
Yeah. So there's a lot of great stuff in there that you just said. The first thing I'll take, which is super quick, is just that it usually is managers first and then agents. But I know, I mean, there's so many different combinations. I mean, Matt, you and I know Jay Jameson, the writer on Superman and Lois. Yeah. He didn't have a manager when he got on that show. All he had was a lawyer, and his lawyer was a best friend from college. Now that best friend from college didn't get him on the show. He was just a lawyer that was accessible to him that he could use to make sure the contract was legit. So he didn't have anything, you know, and once the lawyer signed it off, he was like, the lawyer's gone. And then Jay's just by himself. But most people, it is manager and then agent. Now, to your question, what's funny is my managers actually didn't help me get my agent. I submitted to an online thing, which maybe this is a faux pas doing this on Script Pipeline, but I submitted to a Roadmap Writers thing, which was free. So I didn't spend money. I didn't spend money for the competition. They had like a free BIPOC thing on Twitter, and they were like, submit your script to this for free. And if we like it, we'll contact you and send your stuff to agents. So they liked Wonder Drug, and they sent it to, and this, I love this story because it shows like the ratio of like passes to recommends. They sent my script to 8 agencies. One did not bother reading. 6 read and passed. The final and 8th one was A3 Artists, which used to be Abrams, and they rebranded. They read, they loved it, and they said, we want to meet with you and we want to sign you. So it's like, you know, I've had people read that script and say, this is one of the best things I've ever read in my life. That script, 7 people passed on it, and or 7 agencies passed on it, and one took it, and they've gotten me like 5 or 6 staffing meetings in the last 3 months with that one script. So it's like, you know, and I'm not saying that's proof that the script is good. I'm saying it's proof that they know some legit people that they're sending that script to, and that they know what those people will want to read, right? So it's a period script, and it's a limited series script, and there's probably execs out there who do not want to read those 2 things. So they know who to send it to, who's going to take to it, and how they can use that as to build on my trajectory through my career, if that makes sense. And so, yeah, so me, it was managers, then agents, then getting staffed.
Okay. Ronnie, what was your representation process sort of like?
So I didn't get my manager until COVID. So everything that I was doing, everything that I've gotten up until 2020, I got mainly because I was also on the production side of things. And so I would always either segue a production experience into a writing experience, or, you know, through a previous production experience, I get my name dropped for something with writing. And so when COVID hit, and I was basically in a place where I had been out of LA by then for like 4, almost 5 years, and I had contemplated moving back. And then COVID hit, and I was like, holy cow, I'm probably really not going to go and move back to LA. How do I continue on working in LA while not being in LA? And so that's when I was like, okay, it's time for me to really try to reach out to a manager. And that year I had a short film script that had made it to Sundance. And I used that as leverage, because in previous years, even with the other writing jobs and being in the room on different shows, I wasn't getting much traction. And so I don't know, something just aligned when I started sending out my information then, and I got my manager, and he's been getting me jobs since then. I think you're muted, Matt.
And you're still not in LA, or you just go back and forth?
I'm in, I'm in Georgia. Yeah. And I go back at this point. My plan is to, if I could keep this up, because I feel like it's a game right now, like I'm running game on the industry. And it's only a matter of time before it's like, no, we're all the rooms are still going to be in LA and you got to come back. But if I could keep this up, I go back to LA like twice a year.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
And Allie, what about you? When was that? When did the rep first enter your world?
I believe she's frozen.
I think she's frozen too.
Or she's very still.
Or she's
like, art unto itself.
Faking us out. We'll come back to that question. Maybe she'll pop back in. She'll come right back in and we'll get back to that.
Okay.
I am curious. I guess I should ask this maybe when Allie comes back, but I'm curious if it's everything you thought it was going to be. Like when you were like, oh yeah, I'm got this room job and I'm going to go, I'm going to quit my job teaching and I'm there. Like, is it what you expected it to be?
Who is this for? Is this for Ronnie?
Anybody. Anybody.
Go ahead, Ronnie.
Yeah. I'll say, and you guys know this, Matt and Gene, I had a bad experience last year. I had a bad experience with a major studio, and it was mainly because I didn't feel like my voice was being heard. Mm-hmm. Previously one of the rooms I was in, it was all stand-up comedians, and it was an amazing experience. And I felt seen and I felt like I was part of the team. So that one kind of jarred me. And I've heard horror stories. I mean, we had a writer on my current show who came in freelance, and he's been in the game for a long time. And he used to be a writer on Rugrats. And he was telling us about an experience where one of the showrunners basically hit him on the head with the script because they were upset at a rewrite or something like that. And I'm like, I've heard the horror stories. I had never experienced it, but I did experience that, and it almost made me want to quit. Mm. And I started to question myself, and I'm like, I can't deal with this. I can't deal, you know, this is a workplace, but there's so many different nuances and layers to it sometimes. And people don't have good intentions are also in those rooms. And once you realize that, it's like, okay, well, now I'm dealing with this experience. How now am I going to let that make me better? And going forward, I know what to tolerate and what not to tolerate at the same time, learning from that experience. So other than that, for me personally, everything else has been great. And I love it. Like I said, I'm living my dream. It's just, you know, sometimes things happen, and I basically have to tell myself, like, if something does happen in the future, which it seems like you never know, because people are people, you know, don't let it shake my foundation, which is, this is what I love to do. And I'm not going to let anybody take that away from me.
Yeah.
To clarify too, I don't think you meant the person you're talking about had a bad experience on the Rugrats show. I think this was a person you met on Rugrats, right? That had a separate bad experience.
No, he was on Rugrats.
Okay.
Oh, back in the day, this is basically, he was telling us a vintage story in this industry story. And I was just like, man, like somebody hit you over the head with a script. And he said it in stride, like, yeah, that happened. And I'm like, I would want to kill somebody. Like, are you?
As long as it's a vintage story. I was trying to clarify either way, just so you don't.
Not the current Rugrats. I don't know what's going on over there.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's the stuff. Back in the 90s.
Yeah. And I think that kind of stuff all comes back to like a lesson I like, you know, drummed into my kids' heads is that you can't own other people's shit. Like, people are going to behave the way they behave and they make those choices, but it's how you react to those choices that they're making.
Right,
like that's all you can control. So you, by saying, you know what, I'm out. Even if it gave you a moment where you felt you wanted to quit, it still got you where you are today by standing up for yourself and saying, I got to get out of here.
Exactly. And I'm proud of myself for not staying, which is one of those things where in the past me 20-something-year-old me would have been like, okay, but I've got to stick through this. I've got to stick through this disrespect. But almost 40 me, no.
I think, and that kind of brings me to another thought was, is that, you know, we work so hard as writers to get noticed, to get validated, to get that break. You know, you feel like that break is never going to come and you'll like do. So a lot of us tend to either put up with abuse or doing stuff for no money or, you know, all that kind of stuff, just because we're like, oh, we can't say no. Like we can't say no. Cause what if this is it? What if this is my break? You know? Right. And I think that is really hard for writers to figure out.
I think this is a good point too, not just in terms of the workplace environment, but the types of reps that you have, the types of writers you're hanging out with, the types of writers groups you're in. If you feel that something is abusive or toxic or just uncomfortable, it might feel like in the short term, it's going to negatively affect you, and it may, but isn't it better just to remove yourself from that situation?
I would say after having that experience, 1,000%, I think of like where I would be mentally right now if I had stayed on that show, and I would not be happy. I would not. And right. So I'm really, like I said, I'm proud of myself for having the goal to actually move forward instead of just accepting that situation, because it's not necessary to treat people a certain way, that way. No.
Sure. Yeah. And it's sort of like dating. Like if you're dating the wrong person, you're not available when the right person comes. So
Sean has only had wonderful experiences, and he tells me about this every other day. So he's got no negative stories.
But is it what you thought it was going to be, Sean? Like,
yeah, I mean, pretty much. I went in assuming that these were going to be very smart, capable people, especially when I knew I was going to be in a room with Shore. I mean, the guy, you know, did Parks and Rec and The Good Place and Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Rutherford Falls. I mean, you don't do all these things and not be good at your job. What I didn't know, you know, I'd heard good things about him, but you never know the things you hear about people in this town. You don't know for sure until you confirm it for yourself. Like as a journalist, they say trust, but verify. And so that's what I did. And it was readily apparent within an hour that the guy was great. And so, in terms of like how the room ran, yeah, I mean, every room is different. I'd heard that too. So I went in knowing that, okay, that, you know, a writer's room is not a monolith. You know, they're all so different, especially, you know, what genre are they? Are they comedy? Are they drama? Are they hour long? Are they 30 minute? Are they animation? Is it a limited series? Is it a procedural? And so, you know, Field of Dreams is a streaming limited series. And so that room was very much, you know, for the first several weeks, they call it blue skying it. You know, let's do the whole plot, you know, the whole narrative from episode 1 to episode 7. What does it look like? What do the arcs look like? And you're just throwing stuff at the wall in the rooms. Like person A says something, you pick up the ball, you say something else. The next person picks up the ball and goes further. And, you know, with Chicago PD, it's a little different because it is a procedural that this is its 10th season. And so, you know, the mechanics of that are so like diametrically opposed to the mechanics of Field of Dreams, which is a limited series on a streamer. You know, overall, yes, it was what I expected, down to the fact that each room is different and these rooms are just both different.
Well, was like when you're walking into the Chicago show, like you're with staff that's probably been there for a long time. Like that has to be a little intimidating.
So, I mean, yeah, that's an astute observation. I got very lucky because the year before there was only 5 writers, and 2 of them left. And so coming in now, it's like, okay, well, we're going to have to restock with a few more writers. And so now this year we have 8 and 4 of them are new to the room. Well, I should say 3 of them are new to the room. 1, this is only her 2nd season. Mm-hmm. And so you combine that with the showrunner and the EP, and it is still kind of a new eclectic group. I mean, they're working with 3 writers they've never worked with before and a 4th writer they've only known for a year. Now, if I walked into a comedy, like let's say this was 5 or 6 years ago and I walked into the room for How I Met Your Mother, which I'm guessing probably has 12 to 16 writers, because you need a whole lot of writers in a comedy room. Walking into a situation like that would have been very like, you know, nerve wracking. And, you know, I would have been like, I am the lone new guy in a room of 15 other people who all know each other. You know, Chicago PD was not like that because we were all kind of new, you know, someone just said 16. So I guess, yeah, there you go. So yeah. And someone just said your cat is adorable. Indeed she is. Yes.
And by the way, Allie's trying to get back. Her computer's being funky and rebooting and doing its thing. So she'll be back.
There were a few questions about samples, and I think most of the attendees here are, I would assume, writers. Sean, your samples have kind of run the gamut in terms of genre, and you know, you didn't really have a crime drama sample per se for Chicago PD, or really anything specifically along the lines of Field of Dreams. What would you recommend? And this question is for both of you. What kind of samples would you recommend writers have that kind of hit upon sort of like a broader landscape? If you're writing for animation, for example, maybe this question go to Ronnie first. If you're writing for animation, do you need specifically a half hour animated sample, or can it be something a different type of half hour, live action half hour?
My two samples are animated samples. What got me in at Nickelodeon and for Disney Junior was actually a 16 page, which would be like an 11 minute sample. And it was an adult comedy. And what I found with a lot of these children's animation shows, the story editors and the showrunners, they kind of want to see something a little more mature, something that really shows your comedy chops outside of, like, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, which is what we're actually writing. So, you know, so my samples are adult animation samples, but those have been getting me children's animation shows.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And then those are the main two samples that I'm using right now. But in the past, I have used live action features to get my stuff as well. So it's not necessarily, do you have to have something animation? I don't think that's 100% necessary, but it does help that you come in understanding the nuances and the slight differences between animation writing and live action writing.
Right. Just looking at it from the types of scripts that we get, I don't think we get like a single half hour, like kids show, you know, script. But some of those writers may end up writing for a kids show at some point, and it's going to be based on some other sample. So I just wanted to kind of dispel the myth that if you want to write for X show, you need a sample exactly like X. You know, that formula isn't quite true.
Yeah, and heard that they don't want a sample from their show because...
Well, they can't read a sample.
Right, they can't. Yeah. Right. And a lot of people don't realize that. They'll write something for the show that they dream of being on.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Sean, did you have anything to say about writing samples and your experience with that, and what, any tips maybe for people, you know, what should they be aiming for when they're creating a sample?
Yeah. I mean, so again, this is one of those questions that's great. And it's also great to hear from multiple vantage points because everyone's POV is different. Everyone's experience is different. A lot of people get input from their managers and their agents when they write pilots. I was kind of in perhaps an enviable position because I wrote pretty much every pilot without manager supervision. Like my manager that I signed with, my first manager that I left after 20 months, he really didn't have any input in any of my pilots. And he signed me based on two pilots I had already written. So then when I was with him, I wrote like four more. And so, you know, my guiding principle for writing pilots was always, and this might be overly broad, but it was always, what do I want to see? What would I want to watch on TV? And it's like, if I'm writing something I wouldn't want to watch, then I'm wasting my time because I'm not going to want to write it if I don't want to watch it. And then after that, when I would sit down, when I got an idea I was excited about and it felt inevitable that I was going to write it, I didn't really outline that much my first like five pilots. A lot of people have to outline, and if that's your thing, please, by all means, do it. In fact, a lot of reps will tell you, you know, show me the outline, and you should listen to them if they tell you that. I didn't. Mine was more of, what are shows that I've watched that I've loved whose stylizations could be applicable to this. And I could kind of model my sample over that show's stylizations. Maybe not that show's narrative, because I don't want to feel like I'm just emulating something, because then it's not original. But like, so I wrote kind of a climate change type drama. And I, you know, when I sat down to write it, my first thought was, okay, this is probably going to be an ensemble. And when I think of ensemble, one of the first shows I think of is something like The Wire or Treme, because these just have like 8, 10, 12 disparate characters who are off doing their own things. Sometimes they're in the same unit. Sometimes they're completely separated. And I really liked the way that that show felt like almost the, those shows felt like a, like novels, like very expansive 500-page novels. So when I wrote Lost in the Flood, that was kind of my guiding principle. And, you know, I wrote that in like 2019. Fast forward 3 years, I've taken 2 staff meetings from that one script alone. And one was Station 19, that firefighter show on ABC. And when I took the meeting, I asked her point blank. I said, look, Lost in the Flood is nothing like Station 19. Station 19 is very rather proudly and obviously a nighttime firefighter soap opera. That's pretty much what it is. Lost in the Flood is an ensemble that's kind of like The Wire, where a bunch of characters are living in one city and they're kind of contending with climate change. She told me point blank that she liked my characters and my characterization and how I gave them different personalities, different voices, and how I connected them all through their experience in this one town. And that's what they were kind of looking for, to add a new voice to the show. So, you know, that's a perfect example of your question, which is, should you write to the show that you want to get on? I didn't write a firefighter soap. I wrote a climate change ensemble that takes place in a city kind of like I grew up. And now all of a sudden she's reading it and saying, this is the type of voice you want, you know? So yeah, that's a long kind of rambly answer to say, I would not focus on writing something that you think is exactly like the thing you want to be on. I would write something that captures your voice that you would want to watch, and then, you know, let the chips fall where they may.
That's great advice. And Allie, we're talking, welcome back. And
sorry about that.
No, it's fine. Technically,
internet started doing this, and then my computer forced an update on me. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
We're talking about writing samples and advice you might have to somebody who, you know, they're creating their samples in their portfolio and something that would get the attention of a manager, or even once you've got a wrap, the attention of the showrunner and kind of get your foot in the door. Like, any thoughts you have about creating that great writing sample?
I think things, it sounded like Sean was saying this as well, but things that are personal to you that only you can say in your voice, I think is really important. One of the writing samples for Scott and I that got us like School of Rock and a bunch of meetings was something we wrote when he was having his first kid. And he's the guy who has a lot of Star Wars toys and Muppets, and like was like, oh crap, I'm going to be the grown-up now. And so we sort of wrote something loosely inspired by that. And I think a lot of people responded to the personal nature of that. But I think also having a lot of different samples, like for BoJack, they read a half hour original pilot we had written about a really terrible superhero. And then also we had a Bob's Burgers spec that we happened to. And I know some people are like, specs don't matter. And I don't think they're the thing to focus on. But in that particular case, it was helpful to have both the original and an animated spec.
The original pilot was live action, right?
Yeah, it was live action. Well, it was live action, but like crazy zany. It was called The Worst American Hero.
Right.
About a guy who finds a superhero suit and he's kind of lazy and he's like, I don't know if I want to help people. And it was, you know, tone wise, I think fit really well. And also that script got us some meetings and some like got us into doing a little bit of development for some animated stuff. And so I think the more samples you have, the better. Being prepared for those opportunities when someone wants to read something is really important.
Yeah.
I think Sean really nailed it too. And it seems so obvious. I tell writers this all the time. You have to write what you're excited about writing, or else it's not going to turn out good. Right. And that's it. That's all I have to say. That's my number one. It's the easiest piece of advice that you can give someone. And every person that I've seen that has broken through on the feature or TV end has done that exact same thing. You know, they haven't tried to write for the market. They've kind of written for themselves with the market in mind, you know. Anyhow, we have, a billion other questions here. I don't
know if
you wanted to take a 5-minute break or not at the hour mark.
Who needs a break? These guys work in a writer's
room. I don't need a break.
I just took one to run to the internet, but
and I'm gonna take one in a second to go grab the beer that I just ordered. So, you know, other than that, we're good.
Well, I just want to make one comment here. Somebody posted in there that they're a writer with a disability, and it's well known that the industry needs more disabled voices. Any advice? I want to point out that Sean's lovely wife, Allison, wrote a great piece for us about disability in Hollywood for Pipeline Artists. So if you go to pipelineartists.com.
I'll drop the link in the chat.
Okay, great. And you'll see it right on the homepage. And also, just in terms of inclusivity and diversity in Hollywood, Sadie Dean and I did a Reckless Creators podcast that I'm probably going to launch tomorrow with Jess, where she wrote a book, Jessica King, wrote a book, about that and how Hollywood should be addressing inclusivity and diversity. And so you'll want to listen to that Reckless Creators podcast tomorrow.
Yeah.
There's also a committee with the Writers Guild where they're trying to focus on that as well and making sure like disabled voices are heard, seen, included in the writing, seen on screen. I feel like this is important to me as well, because I was temporarily disabled. I had 2 back surgeries a couple years ago and like got a lot of insight into like how the world, like, I don't know. I had to use a cane for a while and have just been thinking a lot about that. And yeah, I think that's a huge issue. And then it's hard because sets are hard to get around. I was lucky. I was in School of Rock when I had the first back surgery and they were really nice to me about all that. I'd have a special chair in the writer's room because the Writers Guild does have a committee addressing that. I also think the Gina Davis Institute does a lot, both in terms of representation of women. Final Draft also does have something that Pete, my husband, helped design for Final Draft 11, is like an inclusivity report where you can go and see like how many people speaking are women, or how many people speaking are someone of color, or how many people speaking are LGBT or disabled. So you can kind of start from the beginning, which is what us writers need to do in terms of making sure there is representation on screen. But I think that's,
And one last thing I'll just add is that the WGA puts out an inclusion and equity report every year. So I'll drop that link in the chat. And it's got some really good numbers for where the industry has gone and where it still needs to make some progress. So if anyone's interested, I just put that in there.
Great. Thank you. What do you got next, Matt? Poking around those questions.
I think we should take a 2-minute break just to give people, and when we come back, I have 3 gut reaction questions for all 3 of them that,
okay.
So that will give reason for people to stick around.
Okay.
2 minutes though. No, yeah, no 5 minutes. We don't need 5 minutes, just 2 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, everyone's gone, but we're on break, just so you know. Ronnie's back.
I'm back. I'm here. I never left.
Oh, good.
I did a quick job.
I had to go to the little boys' room, and I didn't want to miss a minute of this because you're all doing so well, and I'm fascinated by all of it. So
people are loving it, and also too, a couple people asked about, you know, reaching out afterwards with questions, and if people have questions for you guys, just send them to symposium@pipelineartists.com, and we will forward them and all of that. And also, if you go to the symposium website, you'll see their Twitter handles, so you can follow them and just talk to them there too.
Alternatively, if you want to ask a question, just tag Pipeline Artists on Twitter, mm-hmm. and I'll retweet it, or loop in Sean, or Ronnie isn't on Twitter that often. God bless you.
Try. I'm going to try.
Okay. Or Allison too. We can perhaps answer some select questions through there too, because there's so many questions here that we're not going to get to all of them. I don't think.
Like what internet service I use that went out?
What's the internet service?
Everyone would love to know that.
I'm hardwired into it.
Don't say it. I don't want like Verizon to like do us.
So, well, why don't we just keep going on Sean?
A special appearance.
Special appearance. Just wanted to say hi.
Bye. We were promoting your latest article.
Yeah, they did actually set it on there that you're okay. She's coming back. Guys, she's coming back.
She could work out in the background while we're doing this.
I do have one question to kick it off, because it's been asked multiple times here, there, and in the chat. And this is another question we get, I think, for every town hall. And it's, how do you get people to read your work? And there's a million different answers to me. There's only like four or five different ways, and then sub variations underneath those ways. But what's kind of your thoughts on all of that? And I'll address it to, throw it to Sean first.
No, not me, because my headphones just, actually, you know what? Fuck the headphones. Am I allowed to curse?
This is a family show.
I'm sorry. Can you answer ask the back half of that question again, Matt? Because my headphones went in and out.
Well, you kind of already answered it before when you all talked about how you broke into the industry and so forth. But how do you get, if I'm a writer, how do I get someone to read my script?
Yeah, I mean, so, and I assume you're talking about pre-representation. You don't have a manager. My experience was very, very difficult in that I didn't have any connections. So getting reads, I mean, I hate to say it, but it was kind of a pay for play thing. Like I would submit reads, I would submit notes, and I would have to pay, you know, $50-$60 for notes. I did have friends who were writers, like not in the industry, but like they were either journalists or something like that, who I could get reads from. So I would like give it to a couple women journalist friends and a couple of men friends who were like, you know, they were dabbling in short stories. And I had one guy who was a published author, but nothing big. I mean, this like best-selling book was like 500 books or something. And so like I would give it to people who I knew and respected. I would get their notes. And that was my very first pilot. And then I would submit it to Script Pipeline and stuff like that. And then I started networking on Twitter, because a very smart woman I met at the Austin Film Festival named Grace Moss, who used to be in charge of, I think, the NBC Writers on the Verge program, which I think has since rebranded to a new name. I don't know the name of it now, but she told me to be active on Twitter. She was like, you know, if you're on Twitter, if you're not using it a lot, use it more. And so once I started doing that, I was able to like network with people. Yeah, someone said NBC launch. Thank you, Olivia. Mm-hmm. I was able to network with people on the ground at festivals and then online on Twitter. And then once you start doing that, you know, the reads start getting requested. They'll say, hey, I saw this on, you know, I saw you were runner up in Script Pipeline. Can I read that script? Right. And it's right. Like, yeah, sure. Let's do a swap. And that's kind of how I slowly started building it. But it took a while. I mean, for a good year or two. Yeah. Once I started writing, there was no one to really to give it to.
Allison?
I mean, for me, I was working in production. So I was meeting people, but it's also like the comedy community, going to comedy clubs, meeting people. With like my first rep, it was someone who I would just see at Conan and talk to and chat and became friendly with. And then he liked our web series and then read our script. So in terms of a rep, that was sort of my way in. Some of the Conan writers, it was through their friends in improv and stand up. And like, I knew some writers who got hired on that show who didn't have reps before and just wrote jokes all the time. That was something I meant to say before the computer froze. Like, they were flexing that muscle long before they were paid to write jokes. Like, I remember one guy who told me he would just like check the news every day and write topical jokes, so he was ready for when someone would read him, if that makes sense. But in terms of like scripts, it was just about meeting people. I mean, like one of the job where I produced a indie comedy feature, like that came out of me meeting a friend at my other friend's premiere. And we stayed in touch and we would go to stand-up shows and we would read each other's scripts and give each other notes. And then he somehow got funding for one and was like, hey, do you want to help me make this? So those relationships are really, really important. But also if someone in the industry will read your script, really respecting their time is important. That was something for me. If like I asked a higher level writer to read something, you can't be precious about your script. Listen to that. I mean, that's going to be the same thing also when you get into a room, is like you're there to support the showrunner's vision. So learning to take notes is a really important thing to learn.
Yeah. And Ronnie, living in Atlanta, what's kind of your take on that?
Well, first of all, I was going to say I obviously need to step my Twitter game up, because it's funny that Sean mentioned that one of the writers in the last room that I was in, he literally got staffed because of a tweet. And it took a year for that tweet to pay off, but it was literally one of the executives saw that tweet, laughed at it, and remembered him. And when it came time to staff for that show, she reached out to him. And I was just like, that's amazing. But what was the question again?
When it comes to getting someone to read your scripts when you don't have that like LA sort of network?
Like Allie, like I have production on my side, and that's really helped me. I would say outside of that, like what I have noticed, especially if you don't have connections, is that desperation can be smelled. And so not putting yourself in a position where you're begging people, or you're just dropping your name of your script on somebody, or asking, you know, going to a panel and asking a showrunner to, you know, you go to a panel with Shonda Rhimes and you ask her to read your script, is like, no, have some respect for the process and understand that a lot of people actually can't read your script because of legalities. Mm-hmm. And so they don't want you coming after them later because you named somebody Paul in your show and they have somebody named Paul in their screenplay that they asked you to read years ago. So I think for me, like what I like to tell people is to have the I make great coffee approach, which I like to offer my services to somebody. For instance, and this was years ago, it was an independent producer, and at that time I was trying to push some of my feature scripts. And instead of asking her to read my scripts, I was like, look, if you're looking for any type of assistance, I've read scripts for contests and stuff like that. If you need me to read, you know, entries for you, I can help you. And eventually we built a relationship and a rapport to where she was asking for my work. So because I do offer service, or I make myself available to people, they make themselves available to me.
So Ronnie, you were mentioning before that you, when working on the production side of it, and then you would get to know showrunners and get to know some of these people who are decision makers, that, you know, how did you ease into those conversations? Like, oh, well, by the way, I'm a writer. Like, you know, because that's something that could be really awkward and uncomfortable, somebody to make that transition from someone looking at them as a PA as compared to as a potential writer on the show.
Honestly, it's such a weird fine line between, you know, being that person with the screenplay in their pocket and like thrusting it into people's faces and just really being cool. So it's like, whenever I'm in that position where I do mention that I'm writing something, or I kind of want this person to consider me for something else, at that point, we're already buddies. So, it's hard to explain. It's so weird.
It's a little like dating. It's like playing it cool at first. And then it's like, oh, do you want a remastered?
I have a screenplay, but if you want to read it, you can. I don't know.
No big deal. You don't have to call.
But on the inside, I'm like, please read it, please. I don't know. I really do like to just make friends with the people first. And then they end up usually asking me to read something. So.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the mechanics of actually working in the writer's room, like how it works? Like, so say you're going around, you're talking about, you're batting ideas back and forth, like Sean mentioned before. And like, so say what happens when the showrunner's like, you know what, Allie, I like that idea. This episode is yours. Then how does that work? Like, do you go off and outline it, bring it back, feedback? How does that work?
Most shows I've worked on, it was like, the beats were decided on in the room with the group and with the showrunner. Sometimes it was like the showrunner had one of the higher level writers running the room if they were on set, or with animators, depending on the show. And then once the beats had been approved, then it was like, go off, write an outline. With School of Rock, we would do a one pager that would also go to Nickelodeon, and then we would write an outline. And with BoJack, it was went off, had a week to write an outline, come back, get some notes. And then I think we had like around a week to write a first draft and then come back, get some notes, do a quick rewrite on the first draft, and then it would go to table. So it's kind of quick, but also like you need to be able to have a fast turnaround. But yeah, the beats were usually decided on ahead of time because they want to have the structure there.
And what about like those studio notes that you get, like, you know, I want to say something.
for School of Rock, you would get the notes, I think, every step along the way. Mm-hmm. BoJack, I'm trying to remember, but I think it was we got notes more at the table read. But they also left Raphael kind of alone a lot because, like, it was such a specific vision, BoJack. So they're like, you know what you're doing. Like, I mean, they still gave notes, but I feel like compared to some other shows, like I was on an NBC show as a writer's assistant. I felt like they noted the showrunners to death. So it just depends on each show, but whatever, it's like, you're there to serve as the showrunner. So whatever notes they want you to take, you take them, and move on.
There's so many questions in here.
The one thing I'll add real quick, going back to the previous question about getting reads, I know this is rare, and like when it happened, it's so rare that people think it'll never happen to them, but sometimes the flip happens where someone fairly prominent asks you what your script is about, and mm-hmm. you need to be prepared for that. You need to have, you know, the old cliche, you know, elevator pitch. If Spielberg is an elevator with you, what do you say to him? You have 60 seconds. That literally happened to me at a film festival. And a screenwriter asked me, his name was Michael Green. He co-wrote, you know, Blade Runner 2049, Alien Covenant, several other fairly large films. He saw on my name tag that I was a finalist. He saw the name of my script. He asked me what it was about. I gave him a 60-second pitch. He loved it and said, send that to me. And so I sent it to him. And he said, I love this so much that I'm going to send it to a manager. What I found out later was that what he meant was my manager. He sent it to his manager. And that's the guy that reps me today. And that's the guy that got me staffed on Field of Dreams. And so it's like, you know, that I'm not saying you can plan for that, because that, you know, if I had not gone to that festival, hell, if I had not been in that one, you know, it was a brunch that this happened. And if I had decided not to go to that brunch, that would have never happened. So mm-hmm. it's like, you know, you can never plan for that. But the one thing you can do is prepare for if someone asks me what my script is about, have a succinct 60-second, you know, response to that. That isn't you reciting the entire script from teaser to end for 60 pages, right? Because no one wants to hear that. So have a succinct response ready. And you never know. I mean, the worst thing they're going to say is, okay, cool, great talking to you. And then that's it. But mm-hmm. if it's a good idea and you have it down, I mean, you know, that's it. And it took, I mean, I ran into him in 2017. I didn't sign with Luke at Three Arts until 3 years after that. So it took 3 years for that to come to fruition. But I mean, you just never know when that stuff's going to happen. So,
yeah, I mean, the film festival, I mean, I went to the Austin Film Festival a lot, both like 10 years ago where I had some scripts make the top, whatever it is, 20%. And then more recently I got to go and be part of the roundtable. But like, it's great. They have a giant badge and, you know, like the name of your script, like what it made or whatever you're there to do. So it's like an easy way to socialize. And those festivals were, it does have like a nice, comfortable vibe. It's such a great place both to meet writers. Those are great. I mean, Sean and I actually met, what year was that? Was that 19?
I think it was 2018, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, that's right. Because I had a baby in 19. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wasn't that the Austin Film Festival? Oh, and that's a great joke, Colin, pitching it.
Oh, Matt, I think you're muted, Matt.
No wonder nobody's listening to me. I'm just so used to being ignored. What was I saying? You know, because I was muted. You met Michael Schur at AFF too, right? Before you even got on Field Dreams?
So that's a great point. I took a meeting with Mike Schur the first week of October. And then 10 days later, in a fluke of strange coincidence that, again, you could not plan for, I was up for a finalist award at AFF the same time that he was up for his achievement in television writing award at AFF. Uh-huh. And so, you know, we literally were in the same room about to go on the same stage. I actually had a whole speech planned that was kind of strangely subliminally targeting Mike Schur in case I won. Spoiler alert, I did not win. So I did not get to say the speech. It is still folded up in a suit jacket somewhere. But we did run into each other after that. And I told him like, hey, you know, I've been thinking about a couple of ideas for the show in case you're still, you know, haven't chosen someone to staff on it. And he had not chosen anybody. And so I made a couple pitches to him. One of the pitches I made, he like straight up said, oh, we are doing that. I've already written the first two episodes and that's kind of exactly what we're doing. And so I perhaps stupidly thought, okay, well, I just pitched something redundant. But really what it turned out was he was impressed that I was on the same wavelength that he was on. And so 3 days later, you know, my manager sent me the text that said he just submitted your name for approval. So, mm-hmm. You know, again, you can't, I'm a broken record. You can't plan for that. But if you apply to these festivals and you go there and you try to do the work to network and get outside of your writer shell, your writer hole that we're always kind of stuck in, then it can pay dividends. You just don't know how, you don't know when, but hopefully right. It will.
And look, I'm biased because I run Pipeline, right? And we have contests and so forth. But when people ask, like, what are the ways to break in, or contests worth it? I'm like, yeah, contests are worth it if you place as a finalist or a winner. If it's a good contest, if it's a good fellowship, they should be making those introductions or at least putting some mechanism in place, like AFF does, to put you in the room, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. So good. I'm glad you told that story.
We might have to do some rapid fire questions. Sure. Want to know about, somebody's asking about, how do you prepare for those meetings?
Shower.
Come out.
Look up the person's work, like some of the other show, like if it's a development exec, what they've developed, what they have seemed interested in, kind of have something to say, but also like they're there to get to know more about you. So just being comfortable and chatting about yourself. If it's a pitching meeting, then practice your pitch a lot. Like it, I mean, that's like a performance and you want it to feel natural. So if it's pitching, yeah, practice for your friends, your spouse, whoever, have that down where it's concise.
Yeah. I was going to say, be yourself, you know, feel like you belong there. That's just be as comfortable as you possibly can, because you've gotten this meeting for a reason. So be prepared, but also be comfortable, be, you know, just bring out that personality and see them as somebody that you already know. That's what I would say.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I said I had a pitch meeting. They didn't buy the show, but it was at Universal, and we spent maybe like half an hour just talking about whiskey and stuff before we even got into the pitch.
Yeah, I was just going to say it kind of depends on the type of meeting, like if it's a general meeting, if it's a staffing meeting. For the staffing meetings that I took, I always watched the previous season that's available for the show, like as much as I could. Like for Chicago PD, I think I watched 8 episodes of the previous, of like the most recent season, which was the most I could cram in because I had like 16 hours notice. Mm-hmm. And for the Michael Shore meeting, I watched several episodes of shows that he had done. If it's a general meeting, like Allison and Ronnie have said, you know, look up the information. Who is this exec you're meeting with? What have they done? What previous companies were they with? You could ask them, hey, I saw you were at Sony and now you're president of Don Cheadle's company. It's like, how did you jump from that? And what are you looking for? And what are the differences between the two companies? Anything you can do to kind of prepare, just take 20 minutes to try to look that person up.
Mm-hmm. Best advice someone ever asked you about being a TV writer, and what was your answer?
Should I? I don't know who's going. I guess
thinking.
Jump in.
So wait, sorry. So could you repeat that?
The best advice that anybody, you know, that somebody, best question somebody asked you about being a TV writer, and like, you know, that they were looking for advice from you about being a TV writer, and how, what was your response?
That's a hard one to answer. I might take the flip of that, which is maybe what was the best answer I got important writer that I asked a question about. I remember talking with Eric, I'm going to butcher his name, but his name is like Eric Heiserer or something. Yeah. He did Arrival. Yeah. Yep. And I think he was nominated for an Oscar for it. Great writer, super down to earth, great guy. I ran into him at like the Atlanta Film Festival and we talked for about 20 minutes. And I remember asking him, well, I think someone else asked him, you know, how many pilots he had written. And he said something like 25 or something insane. And I asked him like, well, you know, how many of those have been made? And I think he said like 2 and like another 4 had been optioned. And I asked him, you know, from a psychological standpoint, how do you maintain optimism when you write pilot after pilot after pilot that gets pass after pass after pass? And how do you keep writing after that? And when you're sitting down to write, how do you not tell yourself this will never get made? And he gave me a great answer. He basically said, look, you know, there's the pragmatic side of this business, which is that most stuff does not get made. 99.999% of things don't get made. And he said, and then there's a creative side, which is when you sit down, you have to tell yourself, you have to kind of fool your brain and say, this is the best thing I've written so far. I'm going to put the most effort that I have ever put into anything into this next script. And you know, it'll get made. And it's like, you know, you're kind of fooling yourself, but you're also preparing yourself to try to not have doubt underneath of every single thing you do, right? Because if you do that, it's going to be a miserable experience. So his answer was just like, you know, write it pretending as if it's going to get made. And then, you know, when it doesn't, you're not shocked because a bunch of stuff doesn't get made, but at least you put everything you had into it. And so that's the same thing that I put into everything I write. Like, I mean, I've written Wonder Drug. I've taken great meetings for that. I got my agents off of that, but it hasn't gotten sold. And let's be honest, it probably never will. And if it does get sold, it probably won't get made. And if it does get made, it might be terrible. Like, you just don't know. I mean, you can't control this stuff. All you can do is write something and hope that you get something from it. And whatever it is, you hope that it advances your trajectory millimeter by millimeter. And that's all you're trying to do.
Okay. Somebody, I'm just buzzing through the questions because some of the things I feel like we've already touched on.
There's one question that it's not a short answer. We're looking for short answer questions here. Is that the deal?
No, I mean, whatever. I mean, we've got probably about a half an hour, but I just want to try to get through.
Save me 5 minutes because I have a few quick
questions. By the way, I stole a bunch of time. So does Allison or Ronnie have a good answer to that? I feel like I just rambled and then they didn't have a chance to answer.
I would say, because I get a lot of questions because I do like phone calls and stuff. I get to some people who are actually really discouraged, like they feel like they've done everything that they could do to break in or to get to the next level or to, you know, try to find an agent or a manager and they have no idea what to do next. And they're like, I just feel like giving up. And then I say, go ahead, give up. I gave up in 2018. And what I did was I hit a wall. Everything was just, it wasn't really working out, or nothing was really going forward. And I didn't have anything else to do. And so I stopped. I did yoga. I went out on a date and met my now husband. I lived my life, and everything started coming to me just because I had made those previous connections and sowed seeds in the past. So I think it was maybe like 6 months I had given up, and I didn't necessarily stop writing, but I stopped having this energy of I've got to force the next step to happen. I've got to force the next connection to happen. I've got to force it. It was just a different energy that I had about myself. And so once that happened, I think it was like one random day, I got the email about being a finalist for this Sundance competition. And I was just like, holy crap. Like, I hadn't even done anything I didn't even know I entered the competition. I forgot. Like, I hadn't done anything for a while. So sometimes it's okay to take a break. It's okay to step back. It's okay to understand that right now there might not be much that you can do, but just trust that the work that you have already put in will eventually, or can eventually, pay off, that the connection that you've already made can and will pay off. Sometimes you do have to take a breather.
Mm-hmm. Live your life.
Yeah.
Allie, do you have any like great advice that somebody either gave you that really influenced you, or you give to people?
I mean, my writing mentor, who is an Emmy winner and she's awesome, she said, don't squander any opportunity. And her voice is in my head a lot. Like, and then for me, I always say, be prepared for every opportunity. Like I said, with BoJack, I happen to have a good animated spec and a fun original pilot, and the timing was great with that. I also teach writing students and at Writing Pad, and I talk to them a lot about it. Also, I think something that's really good that Sean was talking about is like being able to pitch your idea. Like, you need to be able to simplify your ideas. I think that helps you as a writer. I think being able to narrow things down and pitch it really helped the writing process move forward. But yeah, just be prepared for every opportunity and keep writing. Breather is good too.
What is good too?
A breather is also good too. And and therapy, and just taking care of yourself, because it's going to be up and down.
Yeah, totally. Somebody asked about starting in the writer's room for the first time. What do you wish you knew when you walked, right before you walked into that door? You must have been terrified.
Yeah.
Starting a job is scary enough, but then starting the job you think it like is your dream. Like, oh my God, I'd be throwing.
Yeah, is there a sense of, did you get anxious the first writer's room you were in?
I think you get anxious. Because every room is like a new place to prove yourself. I mean, right. I remember an old boss who's a high level showrunner saying like he was starting a new, and he's running it, and he was still nervous. Cause it's like, I mean, but that's also comedy. Like, it's like you, same thing for like stand up, when you go up on stage every time, you should have some butterflies.
Right.
Yeah. For me, I was in a room with 16 stand up comedians, and here's me, the production coordinator from the previous season, like, hey,
right.
But it worked out, because I ended up being like the straight man in the room, and the gauge for how, if a joke went a little bit too far. Right. I think if I could talk to my younger self, I would say just feel like I've belonged more and talk more. Not necessarily being an annoying person, but not feeling as intimidated as I did that first time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just another quick question. Like, how many polished scripts should a writer have ready before you start worrying managers or, you know, putting your stuff out there? Did you have a goal of how many you wanted to have done, or just like, whatever, I got a great one, I'm out of here, let's try it?
I think it's good to have more than one, but I mean, there are definitely people who hit with just one. But I think it's good to at least have a couple of samples to show what you can do. And also when you start going to meetings, I'll be like, oh, that's a great idea. What else do you have? So I do think it's definitely good to have more than one, but that said, there's definitely someone who skyrocketed off one script that I'm not thinking of then.
Yeah.
Well, to underscore that point though, when you guys say it's good to have multiple, that's multiple samples. That doesn't mean like I've only written two scripts in my life, right? I'm sure you've written multiple scripts before that just never saw the light of day to build up to that point where you have two or you know, a few good samples, right? Unless you're a brilliant writer and you don't just
everything
you
I
nailed
do
it out of the gate. Of course, I know. I heard on the street that was the case.
Not at all.
I back that up too. Like when I got signed with my first manager, I had two pilots. And when I left him and went to inquire about signing with another manager, I set up five meetings with five managers and I sent them all. They had all read me before except for one. And so I sent them all two samples, and with the understanding that if they wanted to read more, there were plenty more available. But I would have at least two, like two is the minimum, because if you, and when you query a manager, I would say only send one if you have never met that manager before, because you don't want to overwhelm them. But, you know, the worst thing in the world, people think the worst thing in the world is getting a pass. That is not the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world is a manager reading your first script and saying, this is pretty good, let me read a second one, and you saying, I don't have a second one. Because then you had, like, you had that opportunity and you blew it because you didn't have another sample. So I would say, you know, my humble advice is have at least two, and have at least two that have been solidly edited and read and revised and are ready for action. Because if you don't, you're going to kick yourself if a manager reaches out and says, you know, where's the second one, and you don't have it.
And have a second. I was going to say, have a second opinion on your work. Get some notes. have somebody else look at your work. Even though we may think that we're the best, and our mom told us that we're the best, you know, have somebody else read your work and you know, get validated through other people understanding and reading what your voice is before you go out.
I want to ask this question. Can you talk about the fallout for standing up for yourself? Could this get you off a network approved writer list of all the lists, and how long, you know, that kind of thing? Like where you were, like Ronnie, when you were talking about standing up for yourself and just kind of being, did you just resign, or did you, you know, like, I don't want to get like personal, deep into this, but just general advice about, you know, like, would you suggest that somebody just resign tactfully and not get into the weeds about what was going wrong may never get fixed by you calling it out? Or
I would say try your best not to burn bridges. For me, I knew that in some regards I would be burning a bridge for that particular show, but the way that I bowed out, it wasn't a, you know, finger in the face and F you type of situation. It just kind of, it wasn't for me, and it's okay if it's not for you. And I even had on the way out, you know, one of the network executives sat down and met with me. It was like, we hate to see you go. I loved your sample, and you know, come back to us when you're ready. So I'm going to reach out to him probably in the fall when I have a new episode for this show written. So it's just, if something's not for you, you know, I would say do it gracefully. If you possibly can, but I wasn't at that time completely afraid of burning bridges just because it's not my style.
So this is one of my favorite questions, because I'm always interested in what else people are doing. And, are you guys writing stuff other than TV? Like, do you work on novels, poetry, short stories, haikus, restaurant menus?
I have a lot of haikus. No, I don't have haikus. I've been, this is random, but I wrote a horror feature this year that, and I'm shooting it no budget because I had access to a creepy location for free. An idea came into my head. I have no idea if it'll be any good because I'm more of a comedy person, but I've always liked horror movies. So that's kind of a new thing for me. And I write a little.
Also, you tried horror. Are you going to add like a little comedic moments to the horror? I think or are you just going to totally stay away?
Yeah, there'll be some moments of it's more of a like slow build, but there's still some moments. Well, we'll see how it turns out because I have no budget and it's more of a like, ooh, I had access to this. We're going to shoot this. We're just going to do it. But I mean, I think that's good. Also with comedy, like with you can go shoot stuff yourself and it's a good way to, I mean, like, my dumb little web series did get us national press and looked at by reps. And so I think doing that is good. But mostly, and then also working on a new pilot. But now I want to start writing haikus.
my managers and my agents signed me knowing that I write primarily TV. So they had no other expectations for me, but I did just write a feature because I read a short story that blew me away. And I was like, this needs to be a movie. So it's not my expertise, but I was like, I want to adapt this. And so I did that. And I also wrote one short story, which Pipeline Artist has it on their website.
We did.
Right.
It's the only published short story, I'm proud to say.
Right. The only short story I've ever written. I think as a creative, I think you should read multiple, types of genre and types of formats, which is novels, short stories, novellas, comics, graphic novels, if you love them. And then if you feel compelled to dabble in that medium, do it. And if it never sees the light of day, fine, because most of this stuff doesn't. What's hilarious is that I've been in the room for Field of Dreams and now I'm in the room for Chicago PD. The only piece of writing that's ever really been disseminated publicly is the short story that is now on Pipeline Artist's website. And it's the one that I was paid the least amount for. And that's fine, because it's a short story. You're not going to get paid a whole bunch of money for that.
But, how much do you want from us?
I was paid so much money for Field of Dreams, but that's not going to be on
the air. Paying you NBC money.
Right, exactly. But that's my point, is that, the money itself doesn't matter. It's out there now. And I can copy and paste that link and send it to people and say, look at what I wrote. I can't do that for Field of Dreams. I can't do that for Chicago PD. And so go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's kind of the underscoring my advice, which is write multiple mediums, like whatever you want to do. And if it gets published, fantastic, because that's more of your brand that's out there and you can share it with people and have people look at what you've done.
And also people should, like, not that we're probably going to get influx of pitches for articles, but I wrote and ran Script Magazine for over a decade. And a lot of people, that's how Doug Richardson, who wrote Die Hard 2, Bad Boys Hostage, that's how he found me, because he was reading my articles and he said, and he also would, then he started going over to my website and reading my blog. And then he's like, you really know how to tell a story. What about that script you're working on? Can I read that script? So like, you can tell when somebody writes an article, it's telling a little story. So
even a tweet.
You know? Like getting your voice out there anywhere.
You write a lot of tweets and Twitter has, but like just this past weekend, it was one of my dumbest tweets, but Henry Winkler liked it, the Fonz, and responded to it. And then like years ago when I was getting married, do you remember when Andy Dick crashed my bridal shower?
Mm-hmm.
Like that got Twitter fame for some reason. Twitter can be a fun place. And then also, I write a lot about politics on Twitter, my anger. But also, jokes on Twitter have definitely gotten me followers in comedy. And so, every avenue you can go.
You never know what you're going to be good at writing. You might think, I want to write screenplays. I'm only going to write screenplays. Sean had never written a piece of fiction, I don't think, until he wrote this short story, right? And he was inspired on a train back from Northern California or something, right? And he wrote it, and he's like, hey, I wrote a short story, you want to read it? I'm like, Fine, send it. They sent it, and I'm going to revise history and say, I loved it. Published. No, I said, it's okay. Let me see what Jeannie and Peter are our book pipeline exec thing. Because I'm too close to Sean. I'm biased. I don't want to, like, let me see what they say. So actually, knowing somebody in the industry, in this case, nepotism worked against you. Because I originally said no to publish it. But they're like, yeah, that's welcome, great. Sean. And I looked at it with, yeah, I looked at it with fresh eyes. And I'm like, yeah, it actually is pretty solid for someone who had never written fiction before. And it's because you're a good storyteller, right? So for the yeah. people out there who are just writing novels or just writing scripts or just writing haikus, you never know what you might be able to transition to really, really well. So that's why, like you said, just explore these other mediums as much as you're able.
Yeah. And I think for all the people out there listening who are screenwriters, which is probably what the bulk of our audience are, like, I'm a big fan of taking your scripts and turning them into novels. And you will learn more about your story that then might make you say, oh, I'm going to go revise that script. And, you know, just stretch your mind, get out of your comfort zone, try something new.
Can I just show you something? Because Sean made a little sad face. And every year I have the finalists sign a thing. And this, Sean got runner up that year. And how do I angle this? Wait, why is this not angling properly?
I'm getting dizzy.
Wow, in control, I'm the worst director, but you can see Sean's sad face there.
Runner up. It says Sean Colin Smith, runner up, sad face. And I stand by that signature because I was very sad.
I want to tour my office and get really dizzy. Anyway, sorry. I had to acknowledge the sad face. That said, I do have three questions. Let me flip my camera. What the production quality of this Zoom is just... I have three questions, one for each of you before we end.
Uh-oh.
And you okay. have to answer it within 5 seconds. It's one of those like gut reaction, like, okay, I'm going to answer honestly because I'm not going to think about it. Ready?
Would you like to do that now? Or would you like that to be the cherry at the top of the night?
Well, I don't want to, it might bomb. So let's not.
Okay. Let's just do it now.
Do it now. All right. To Allie.
Yes. First.
Most iconic TV character.
Ooh.
In your Fonz. Opinion.
In what?
The Fonz.
I mean, the Fonz is pretty iconic. Yeah. I also, I mean, I love Sam Malone in Cheers. There's something about Cheers that's like, okay. is a perfect. Yeah.
All right. Sam Malone. One of our previous.
Ladies.
One of our previous finalists used to write for Cheers a long time ago, then took a break from the industry and, you would have a wonderful time talking to her, I'm sure.
I mean, I've showed the pilot in class before for students because I think it's such a perfect like master class in writing and introducing characters and just quick jokes.
100%, totally. Okay. Sean Colin Smith. You ready?
I'm ready, yeah.
Okay. The most memorable line from a TV series.
That's what the money is for. Don Draper, Mad Men.
Oh, I could have called that one.
And it's, I can tell you what episode it is. It's from season 4 of The Suitcase.
Wow. You were oddly prepared for this question. Very good. A+, both of you so far. Ronnie, best TV show of all time.
Ooh, I Love Lucy.
Ooh, all right.
Ooh. She was a pioneer, of course, but everything that she went through behind the scenes, just, I feel like that led to that whole series just being gold. I've watched it since I was a little girl and I've probably watched every single episode, maybe 3-4 times over.
Can I ask Ronnie, I'm sorry, Matt, to interrupt. I have to ask a follow-up. Ronnie, the first time you watched I Love Lucy, was it at Nick at Night, like on Nickelodeon, like at nighttime? Because that's, I watched it for years as a kid and that was my first exposure to it was on Nick at Night.
Nick at Night. And it's so funny because my grandma would make me watch shows like this, but that was the one where I was like, let's watch I Love Lucy. Like for some reason, I was just drawn to her comedic timing and, you know, what she would do with, I mean, her slapstick, like she was incredible. I still haven't seen, Being the Ricardos because I'm scared to watch it.
Yeah, like what if it like, live up to your expectation?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I love that.
Matt's little like quick game, like.
Wait, I'm here. Could you believe that my computer? Could you believe that my computer also is now updating randomly?
Oh my gosh!
Today, I was like, "What?
My gosh!"
Wait. Okay, so I want to hear more questions, Matt. Please.
You're on audio.
No, I'm not a question. That was my last question. Ironically.
Oh, that was it. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the room. Are rooms back to in-person now or still mainly over Zoom? If Zoom, are those writers from outside of LA? Ronnie, I know you're remote, but Sean, are you remote?
I'll tackle this in two parts. In Field of Dreams, we were hybrid. It was in-person and over Zoom. At one point, someone got COVID, so we went back to Zoom for that. But it kind of went back and forth. For Chicago PD, it's very much, it was in person the first 2 weeks. And then this week we started just working on our own. So we're not even Zoom right now. We're just sit at home, write your stuff, and then submit it for regular updates from the showrunners. What's interesting about that is that one of the writers lives in Jersey. Another writer lives in Oakland. So now they're back. Like they're back in Jersey and back in Oakland. And there is no, you know, expectation of having to live in LA for them. They know that they hired them knowing that they lived far away, mm-hmm. and they're fine with that. So,
do you think that is going to remain that way, or will it change eventually, and everything will be back in LA?
That's a fantastic question. I think the industry as a whole doesn't know the answer to that because the last 2 years have kind of proven that. You don't have to have everyone in the room to make a fantastic show. Like Better Call Saul is my favorite show of the last 6 years. And its entire sixth season, I believe, was broken over Zoom. And so it's like, if they can do that, then any show, in my opinion, should be able to. That being said, there is no replacement for being in person. There's something about the psychology and the warmth and the personable nature of being in a room with 8 to 10 to 12 to 15 other people, as long as they're good people. If they're pieces of shit, then it's terrible. But if they're good, then, you know, that's what you want to do. And so I don't know the answer to that. I like being in person, but it's much more accessible for people who can't live in Los Angeles to have a Zoom room. So I'm eager to see where it goes.
And Ali made an excellent point.
I miss snacks. But also, like, even if you do live in LA, like, I have a 2-year-old who's not vaccinated yet. So it's like, it's different risks. But I do think there's nothing that replaces the energy of, especially for comedy, being in a room together. And also, like, you have sometimes room bits. I don't know if this happens as much in drama rooms, but there's definitely room bits. And while you can do some room bits over Zoom, it's not the same as when you're in person. And I think that, but I don't know what will happen.
And also just grabbing lunch with other writers, like, you know.
Yeah, taking a walk in the lot. Like,
yeah.
But I mean, I have friends who also like direct and act, and they're figuring it out and they're doing lots of COVID testing and keeping people pretty safe. But it's just hard to know. I mean, I know 10 people who got COVID in the last 2 weeks who were
killed. Yeah, it seems like a lot of people lately.
Yeah.
Pandemics
aren't fun, guys.
Yeah. I feel like it might not end up being a blanketed answer. I think it's going to be left up to the show and the showrunner and the people in charge, what they want to do. They might have, you know, the majority of the people in LA, but they really like this one writer in Timbuktu. And so that writer is able to Zoom. For me, I feel like I would go back to LA for rooms, but because of the shows that I'm on, because the job lasts for so long, it's just, it would be me upheaving my life. So,
So here's a question I want to touch on, because I saw it bouncing around a couple different times. And I know Allie has a writing partner who she works with. So could you talk about that writing partnership when you're in a room, when you as a partnership team are staffed in a room?
Yeah. I mean, it is a little bit like a marriage. So if you're going to be working with a partner, like you really want to know, make sure, I mean, besides knowing they're funny and a talented writer, but also that they're reliable, that they, you know, like have their shit together. Cause that's important because you're going to be relying on that person. Your income's going to depend on them some of the time. And, but in terms of being in the room, I mean, with Scott, his background is also in performance. He was a Groundlings guy, like in the Sunday Troupe. He's been on, acted on a bunch of stuff like Rick and Morty and Kimmel and Conan. And so for us, like having that energy back and forth, both when we're working on drafts for shows or working on pilots, we would, you know, we would write and then we would also read everything back and forth to each other and just like feel the energy of like, is something funny? And then in a room, I mean, it's having someone there who I think that can sometimes make you more comfortable the first day because you have your friend there. So it can be a good experience, but I definitely, you want to make sure if you decide to work with a writing partner, it can be a long-term relationship and make sure that they're someone you really like and respect. And I know some people who've started out with writing partners and then gone their own way. Like a Simpsons writer I worked with, I think he worked for the first couple of years with his partner and then they did their own stuff and that his partner started moving more towards directing. But I think it can be really good to have someone who, you know, helps you stick to deadlines, who Scott and I in the beginning would more write sitting next to each other on my couch, looking at stuff on the TV as we got like kind of got better at our craft. Now, sometimes we would take more scenes or acts and then just go back and forth. And then once we have a full draft, we would go through it all together a couple of times. And that was sort of our process.
Yeah. The trick is when you're a writing partnership and you're looking at that as a sample, they don't know who wrote what.
If you're going out as a team, then write a sample together. But if you want to go out by yourself, then don't write with another person because they can't judge you individually based off a script you wrote with someone else.
Right.
So if you're like, I want to write this one script with this person, but they also like never call me back. So I'll just use this. You can't do that. So,
Yep. Here's a good question. Is it a red flag if you have written a lot of scripts but have not broken in yet? What do you say to that, Matt? Ms. Titch?
I say not necessarily. Maybe it just hasn't found the right person that gets your voice. But it also, I think this goes back to what Ronnie was saying. You need to get feedback from somebody, whether you have to pay a service or whether you're lucky enough to have professional people who know what they're talking about, give you honest notes and just feedback on your work. I don't know. It depends. I've known writers who have 2-3 really, really good scripts. And then for whatever reason, they just haven't been able to find the right rep. So it really does vary. But if the feedback on your work is largely positive, again, from people who know what they're talking about, not necessarily like your aunt from Florida, then it's just a matter of finding the right outlet for it. Also, you could have a great script. I could talk about this for a whole nother pod or a whole nother.
I'll have to do a one-on-one with panel. You, Matt.
Yeah, well, there's so much bad advice I can give people. It could be a situation where you wrote something great, but it just doesn't fit into what the landscape wants right now, right? Or it could be something that's really great, but it just isn't quite high concept enough. I mean, a million different variations that are sure to frustrate everybody. I know Sean knows what I'm talking about when it comes.
It's also the odds. I mean, like when I joined the Writers Guild. They said you have a better chance of being a professional baseball player. And I can hit a ball, but yeah, like, I didn't think that was gonna. So like, it is odds. I mean, I know some really talented actors who don't get the right chance, but it's trying to get yourself into the right places. Festivals can help, and just keep writing. But yeah, I don't know if it's a red flag. It's a red flag if you've actually had a lot of people read it and never had positive feedback, that might be.
Well, that's burning red flag. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to ask a practical question. Allie, you have a 2-year-old, and what was that like you know, making that choice, like, did you feel like when you decide, cause you were staff before you had Luna. So like, you know, when you decide, okay, we're going to have a baby and oh my God, what is this going to mean to my career? Like, did you think about?
Oh yeah. I mean,
I would tell her, like, don't worry.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a while to have kids. I had been married a while before Pete and I had Luna, and it definitely was a concern, but I felt like I had checked a couple of boxes, but it still doesn't make it easier to write. Like, cause I love her and I want to spend time with her. So, but also the fact that a pandemic started when she was 6 months old was not my favorite. I got to work on a pilot when she was like 6 weeks or something. And I was like, yay, I'm still me. I can give birth and still be funny. And and then the pandemic happened. I was like, no one can go near my child. You know, it was like that. That was so parenting and trying to write during a pandemic is harder than I would have expected for parenthood. But also now we have childcare options that we feel safe with. And but it is, I think writing can be, you sort of need to be selfish. Like for me, like when I would be on deadline, sometimes, you know, you can write 12 hours or 14 hours a day, you know, or write at 3 a.m. And right now, especially with a toddler schedule, like I don't have that same kind of time, even with having a really wonderful co-parent. My husband is a good father. We're very equal parent. I mean, he's working more right now than I am, but like we are very equal co-parents. I have good support. I'm very lucky and very privileged. But it's still hard because I don't want to like not hang out with her for 12 hours. So it's finding the balance. There's definitely other moms who I think have found the balance quicker and better than I have. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely a concern because you go from like, I can write all day and then I'll say hi to my husband real quick. And then to like, oh crap, there's a human. I have to keep them alive. Now there's this.
The keeping them alive part is a little pressure.
And like, and then emotionally, like I'm someone like it's not just like the like keep her safe. It's like keep her emotionally happy. So you're giving a lot of energy. And that's what I wanted to do. I cared about being a mom, which is why I waited till I was like in a good place myself. So I can give that to her. But also she's already funny. She the other day she was in the bathtub with her best friend and she was going like, look at me, I'm funny. I was like, oh man, she already needs to be funny. Oh crap. We wanted her to go into science.
I think she's doomed. I mean, Allie's husband also does stand-up comedy too, like on the side. So you're doomed. Forget it. There's no science going on here. Somebody asked this question, what shouldn't a writer do?
Chew loudly in the writer's room.
That would do it.
That's a good tip, I think.
I mean, seriously, like when you're spending 12 hours in a writer's room with people and you're ordering lunch and you really get to know their eating habits.
I would say if you're asking what should a writer not do in a writer's room, the answer that comes to mind first for me is repeatedly pitching the same idea that the showrunner has shot down already, because you know it happens. Like and it happened to me in Field of Dreams. I pitched something, and I thought it was like the cure all for some issue. And Mike wasn't mean about it, but he just said like, I don't know if you want to go that direction. And he was right. And so I stopped. I didn't pitch it a second and third and fourth time. I think if you do that, it comes from a place of ego. So like, if it gets shot down, just accept that it's shot down. Don't tell yourself, I didn't pitch it right. He didn't hear what I said, really. Tell yourself, I missed that one and it's time to move on. Because when you watch people fail repeatedly on the same idea, it's awkward, it's weird, it's a waste of time. It's every possibly negative thing that you could expect in a room. So just be careful with that.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, like accepting when they're cutting stuff, because like, you know, you can't be precious about when it's your script you're writing for someone else's show. You can't be precious and they're going to cut stuff. So you just like have to do it with a smile. And yeah, you're there to service them.
Yeah. And right. It's funny you say that, because I wrote a teaser for the episode that I was assigned for Field of Dreams. And I was like, this might be too weird. And I got a text from the executive story editor, like 3 ranks above me, who said, Sean, I just read the teaser. This was like freaking amazing. I will fight Mike if he tries to cut it. first thing that happened in the room the next day, Mike's like, okay, we have to cut this teaser. And it's like, you know, and so you can't take that stuff personally. Like, you just have to be like, okay, you have to know what you're there for. You're there to serve the showrunner. You're not there to serve your ego. And so I didn't fight him. She said she was going to fight him through text. She didn't fight him. But later she took me aside and she said, like, I still think that was an amazing teaser you wrote. And that was a really great piece of writing and you should be proud of it. And so that meant the world to me. And it also gave me enough confidence to be like, you know, Mike knows what he's doing. He's cutting it for a reason. Let me just move on. So,
yeah. And someday she might be a showrunner and say, hey, I want you in my room.
Exactly. And the fact, I mean, she's already been on multiple shows and this was my first show. So that could absolutely happen. Yeah.
And you exactly see- what Jeannie said too, about you can only control your reaction to something. Mm-hmm. If you have a good reaction, it'll pay off in the future, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say don't be afraid to have your idea evolve, throw it out there because people are going to change it and you'll just see it evolve. So don't be too attached to it also, but yeah.
We are at the bewitching hour, but if I could get like a, you know, quick response from all of you of what advice would you give your younger self? If you could go back in time, and Allie, it's probably going to be something about the lake. you know, any advice that might, that you wish, like if somebody had, you wish somebody maybe had told you when you were younger?
I mean, in terms of my early 20s.
Career or anything.
I feel like it took me a little while to, even though I knew I was moving out here to be a writer, I think it took me a little while to take that seriously and like tell some of the bigger writers I was meeting, like, yeah, I'm a writer. Like it took me a little while to say that. And I wish I'd kind of started being firm in it sooner, found my confidence a little sooner. Mm-hmm. And then also buy more Tesla so that, anyway.
Well, yeah. My Netflix stock back in the day or yeah. Apple in the very beginning.
You don't have to worry about the in-between.
I know. Ronnie, what about you? You've talked a lot about your younger self.
Yeah. I would tell myself definitely don't be afraid to brand myself as a writer. Cause I think that's why I ended up going so far into the production route was because I just didn't understand that I actually was a writer, you know, cause I was writing and because I was helping myself get better and better. So started branding myself as a writer, you know, sooner that I definitely would have done that, not doubt myself so much when I was younger.
What about you, Sean?
Oh, that's a good one. I mean, I would probably tell myself to read more because I don't think I read enough scripts, read enough books, read enough short stories. And I think there's nothing more exciting than reading a short story or a novel or a script that stokes your imagination so much that you wish you had written it. And I think when that happens, you feel there's like an adrenaline rush, like whatever the artistic equivalent of that is, there's an adrenaline rush that makes you wish that you could just sit down and write something then. And I think if my younger self had read more, then I would have gotten into the industry a little quicker. But yeah, that's probably it.
Cool. Well, I'm not going to ask Matt Misicich this question.
Yeah, don't do that. That's a trap. Trap question for Matt.
It's
yeah.
a trap. I don't, but thank
I
you.
I have the answer, but it's not. I'll tell you later.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for being on our panel, for letting us pick your brain. Thank you to everybody who attended tonight. And also to check the symposium site, symposium.pipelineartist.com for our upcoming session. Let me just do a quick little plug because I forgot off the top of my head what's next.
It's Danny Siegelbaum's nonfiction.
Yeah, we have, for anybody who's looking to get off to a different thing, we're going to have a nonfiction book proposal. But we've got a lot of stuff coming up this summer that's really fun, like indie filmmaking and Jeff Willis from Marvel is going to do a session about contracts. We got a lot of good stuff coming up for our symposium summer. So stay tuned and check the site often.
It's almost like a year-round conference in the arts.
Almost. Look at that. What a tagline.
I thought it was a good tagline.
It is.
I came up with it.
Exactly.
Thank you, everybody. This was I'm not going to say it was the best town hall, but it was the best town hall yet, I think.
It was great.
Yeah.
It was.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, everybody. All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Symposium is brought to you by Pipeline Artists, a division of Pipeline Media Group. To learn more about upcoming live symposiums, visit symposium.pipelineartists.com and follow us on Twitter @PipelineArtists.